Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, and welcome back to the Grief Gang podcast with me, your host, Amber Jeffrey. The message behind the Grief Gang is to normalise the topic of conversation that is grief. People living with grief can often feel ashamed, isolated, and alone. This podcast was created to break those taboos after I, myself, experienced all of those feelings after the loss of my mum in 2016. I decided enough was enough and we need to talk about this. You'll hear on this podcast an array of stories and experiences, some being my own and some being fantastic guest episodes and their incredible stories. You'll laugh, you'll cry, but I hope above all, I hope you'll learn. I hope you'll learn that you are not alone in your grief journey, that you have a voice and it should be heard, that you and your grief matter. So without further ado, I'll let you enjoy the episode. Happy listening. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Grief Gang podcast with me, your host, Amber Jeffrey. Another fantastic guest episode for you. I don't think I've ever churned out this many guest episodes in like one season. It's normally been, I know in the last year or so, you guys just been used to me just sat in my bedroom just waffling. But I'm so, so glad that all these fantastic guests are now part of the Grief Gang show and sharing their stories. So without further ado, I would like to introduce Jess Bacon, Instagram blogger, writer. Come on, spill yourself. Give yourself a little high five.
I'm loving this. Yeah. I mean, I'm a multi-hyphenate, you know. So we've got Instagram, where I do some social media kind of consultancy as well for like businesses and brands. And then, yeah, freelance journalist as well as like podcaster. Just very creative all round, I would say.
You are very creative. And Jess came onto my radar about, we've been in talks for a good couple months. Yeah. Mostly on my side, because my diary is just an absolute shit show and I'm awful getting back. But me and Jess, we spoke together and I've been following Jess for a while and we've been watching her story and the way you speak about it, and it's really touched me, and elements as well about within your education and going through that at the time of when you lost your person. So I'm really excited to speak with you today and hear your story and to go back to that time in your life and hopefully share some golden nuggets and just hear your story. So obviously we've introduced you, you are Jess, and Jess, there is obviously a reason as to why you are here in the Grief Gang. It's not a nice reason, as we all know. You should all know by now, guys, that this is not the guests who come on here, they're not on here for nice reasons. So Jess, would you mind telling the listeners and the viewers who it is that we are here to talk about today on Grief Gang?
Yeah, so I lost my dad Martin when I was 16. We were a very, you know, close family. I was very similar to my dad. And yeah, when he was 45, he was, you know, incredibly fit, like training for a half, like sprint triathlons all the time. He was running every single day. He was a head teacher. Like, he loved what he did. He loved his family. Was literally, the running joke was, you know, that he was never ill a day in his life. And yeah, he was diagnosed with a grade 4 brain tumor at 45 and then passed away 10 months later. So it's been a journey. And I think even those 10 months we had together, you know, a lot of people don't get that. So I'm very grateful for the time that we had once we knew the diagnosis and to say goodbye. But I'm sure, as you well know, there's, you know, there's no easy way to say goodbye. And there's so many more things you wish you could say to them. So yeah, we're kind of, next week it will be 8 years since he passed away. So it's just been a crazy ride, really.
Yeah. And how has it been? So so obviously with it being next week, how are you feeling with it coming up to next week? So for 8 years.
I always get really funny around the anniversary. I was kind of told, you know, very early on, oh, you'll forget the day. You'll forget the date. Don't worry. And I was like, I don't think I'm going to forget the date. You know, I really don't think I will. Well, literally, like, because obviously I was at school, so it was like pupil support staff. And they were kind of in their 70s at this point and kind of said, oh, you know, I lost my parents kind of like 20 years ago. I don't remember exactly what the day was. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm pretty sure I'm going to remember this date.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. It just stays with you, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And that's really interesting that, as you said, like, those people who said that to you, they were very much older and in their 70s. And so they lost their people, you know, 20 odd years ago. It makes you think, is that a generational thing? Like,
and I think it's a thing, like, you don't know exactly what to do on anniversaries. So I think some people do just sweep it under the rug because, you know, what can you do? But I think it's kind of, it's just another opportunity to celebrate them and the people you've lost and the time you had and everything they meant to you. So we're very much like, we remember, we go out for dinner, we raise a glass, we go to the grave, we lay flowers, we listen to his favorite songs. Like, it's very much like a little mini kind of celebration of who he was and what we had.
I love that. And I'm glad that, that, you know, even though you are feeling a little bit off towards it, that, you know, that day will come and you have, so you, is it quite like, or is it, as you'll say, you do all those things, but is it quite like rigid? Like, you'll do that, even if you wake up on the day, will you be like, maybe I'm not feeling it? So have you ever had an anniversary? I'm going completely off task of like my questions, but because, like I told you before, we'll go off on anything. But yeah, like, do you, and the last 8 anniversaries, or 7 now coming up to 8, has there been ones where you would have wanted to have done all those lovely things that you did, but you've just woken up and gone, nah, not today?
Yeah, I mean, it's been weird because obviously, so he died on the morning of my first GCSE exam, but obviously that was GCSE. So, and because of how exams fall, it meant that every year for the next 4 years, I had an exam, I had a deadline at uni, and I handed in my dissertation in my final year on that day. And so it became more like a commemorative, we remember you, I remember my education. And because he was a head teacher, it was very like, it never really crossed my mind that I couldn't go to this exam. And then from then on, it was kind of like he was part of that journey, even when he wasn't. So it was kind of nice. But again, it meant there was always something I had to do on the day. So you could never kind of
not just.
Exactly. You could kind of fall apart around it. You kind of had to time it. So it was very, you know, surreal. But I think now I've been out of education kind of 2 years, 3 years this summer, it's become more of a, okay, so do we go to work? Like, do we treat it like just a day? And then in the evening, we kind of have that chat, like, wow, you know, 8 years. So I think it's definitely become, reached a point now where I can kind of, I can feel everything I want to feel on the day, as opposed to kind of suppressing it, you know, and letting it out at the last minute after, you know, whatever I've had to do that day.
Yeah. And it must be really, like, obviously abnormal for you, as you said, for the first 4 years you had exams and then in university, and you've kind of now at a point where you can have, you've been given the choice to, you can fall apart now. You can fall apart. I fall apart, but you can welcome, feel like we can imagine. And I want to go back to the first GCSEs, your exam on the day that your dad passed away. But you've woken up every anniversary and gone, nope, can't
ain't got the time today.
Here we go again.
We've got to go to school. We've got to sit that uni exam. We've got to get up and go.
And then now you're at a point where you can actually be like, you can welcome these feelings in without having to put up a barrier up until like 6 o'clock or like 3 o'clock after school. It's like, this is abnormal. But before we go into that, Jess, would you mind going into as little or as much as you like of the story? So you said it was 10 months after diagnosis, dad passed away. But on that morning of when dad had passed away and sort of the lead up towards that moment.
Mm. So I think it was I was 15 at the time. My brother was 13. And like I say, we were a very close family. It was very sudden. And it kind of, as I got older, as the 10 months moved along, it became apparent that my parents were protecting us, you know, from certain information. So they never used the word terminal. Mm-hmm. It was kind of, we hope he'll get better. We don't know how this will go. He's going to have chemo and then radiotherapy and chemo and then radiotherapy. And he had an operation very early on to remove like 90% of the tumor. But they kind of described it like it was a spider's web. So you remove the spider's body, but all the legs are still going to be there and they're still going to grow. Mm-hmm. And so it was very, my dad was a very positive person though. So it was a very like, contrasting thing that he would kind of this every time we went to an appointment the tumor would have grown and you know we'd go out for dinner afterwards and he'd pick up like it was at Christmas time this time we went and we'd been told that actually you know the operation the radio the chemo this is probably like three rounds in had done nothing pretty much and there was like this garland on the table around these candles and he like took the candles out and put it on his head and he was like take a picture because it's grown. And I was like, only you would be like, do you know what? This is a chance for a photo op, for a laugh, you know? And even, and it was just the whole time was like that. So even as it kind of went on and we kind of got to like March times, so he passed away in May, it was kind of February, March. And he did at his school, they had an annual 5 mile run and he dragged his brother along and was like, do you know what? We're going to do it. So he had like, stage 4 cancer and he's just going on this 5 mile run, you know, for a school, for a charity. And then we found out kind of 2 weeks later that the tumor had fallen from his head down his spine, which was incredibly rare, and they'd only had kind of a couple of cases before at Adam Brooks, which is a hospital in Cambridge that he was kind of treated at. And again, that was a running joke, you know, that he was always one of a kind, so of course he would get the rare one. And so it was very kind of, it wasn't lighthearted, but he definitely, we were kind of the family that found the fun in everything and tried to find that, you know, lighter tone that he'd always had with everything. Even kind of with cancer, he was determined, you know, that there would be a funny side, there would be a joke in it. He would get a great photo with it, you know? and I think the best way I can describe that is probably, it was kind of his third or fourth round of chemo. And, you know, they're all sitting in the chairs and I was sat opposite him where he was having his chemo. We were just sat there waiting for, you know, it to be done. Mm-hmm. And there was, you know, very distressed other patients and families around us. And my dad's still kind of like just, you know, bobbing along, like smiling away at me, chatting away. And he turned to the woman next to him and he just said, oh, you know, it's a real shame we're here, but it's nice we've got comfy chairs, isn't it? And I was like, that pretty much sums you up. And I was like, Dad, just don't, like, she's clearly very upset. Just, you know, tell me.
Yeah,
I'm glad you're comfy. Yeah. I don't know. I'm like, oh my God.
But she's like, are you joking me?
I know. I was like, this is not a silver lining situation. I was like, you can tell me, no one else.
Brilliant.
But yeah, but that was his attitude, you know, there was always a good side to it. Someone was always worse off than he was. Mm. So I think they knew where it was going, but I think we were also kind of in denial in a way that it was going to be terminal. And it was only when we got to kind of, March, April time, the tumor had fallen down his spine and we had a Macmillan nurse come around and she said, okay, look, you need to sort out your wills. And you need to make sure that you've got like a hospice lined up or like an end of life care plan. Yeah. And that was a point where we all went, oh, okay. Yeah. You know, this is happening.
Real.
Yeah. And literally we were very lucky. It was all very odd as well. We kind of went, so we literally have a hospice down the road from us, which is like a really old, like stately home. You would never know it's a hospice. Mm. We went to look round on like the Saturday or Sunday And I never really understood, I couldn't get my head around why people wanted to go to a hospice. I didn't really get why you'd want to die somewhere you've only been once and you didn't want to be at home. And again, I was very young. So I kind of thought it would be very like sterile and like clinical and kind of scary, but it wasn't at all. Like it was just wonderful. So we kind of, we went there on the Saturday or Sunday. And then by Monday I went to school and I kind of felt very weird because obviously he had a brain tumor. And at this point, it was kind of leaning on different parts of his brain. So he never forgot who he was or who we were, but he'd have these kind of hallucinations. And so he kind of thought he was already dead. So he'd be like, oh, are we in heaven? Are you an angel? And we were like, oh no, that's really nice. You think that, like, thanks so much. That's so flattering, but no, we're all still here.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of like, and I'd have that kind of surreal experience over the weekend and then go into school and you sat in a canteen listening to your friends talk about like 16-year-old problems, and it was all very weird. But then that was the day I was in a class and I kind of thought, I don't know how I'm going to do this, and I didn't have to because they basically came in and said, he's going to a hospice now, you're going to go there now and you're going to revise your exams there, and that's it, you're done with school. I was like, okay, cool, let's go.
Such a crazy transition for you at 16.
Mad, like mad. And it's one of those things you just have to roll with. Because no one tells you how to do it. So, and in the moment, it's very instinctive. You just feel like, okay, this is what we do.
Yeah.
Whereas you don't really think about it until after, and you think, oh, like how do we get there? Or like, how did you just go along with it? But yeah, so it was a very like surreal experience. And then I was kind of revising in the hospice, like as and when. And I was lucky in a way because it was modular exams back then. So I'd kind of done, you know, 2/3 of everything I needed to do. So it didn't weigh as heavily on that. But it was also, it was just like a very odd thing because I didn't feel like I could give up exams. I don't remember even having a conversation about whether I would go or not. It was just like a, I would go and then come back to the hospice.
It wasn't a question.
Exactly. It was just like, we figure it out when it happened. Yeah, so then, and then it was literally, you know, he kind of deteriorated. He was literally going in to have a medication tweak, and he'd been there about a week, and then they said, you know, he needs to stay here now, I think this might be the time. And he literally deteriorated over the second, you know, week, maybe third week into a little bit. And then that was it. And he, you know, one of the last conversations we had in and out, because at the end he was kind of in and out of a coma, and he kind of said to me, I'd been to like a drama exam and it was like a, just like a practical thing. And we'd done our show and it was nice and all of that. And I came back and he said, oh, I timed it perfectly, didn't I? Because you've just finished your exams. And I was like, yeah, you have, like you've timed that perfectly. And I just didn't have the heart to say like, no, this was just like a, you know, just laugh about. Run. We start on Monday.
We just had a bit of fun. So he's hitting in his head. He's thinking, do not go until Jess has done the exams, until she's done it.
So it was just, and obviously he was a teacher, like he felt like that was really important. You know, and he wanted to be supportive in that, and he felt like that was how he could do that. So it was just a very surreal time, and it feels even weirder to look back on it now, I guess, as well, because you feel so distant to it but so close as well.
And so then, okay, so you sat the drama exam now. Bless him, he thinks he's held out until, I could imagine you being like,
you're just like, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. I've finished the role. I've not even really started. I've actually not even started.
Yeah.
And what's quite poignant with that then is that him passing on the morning of your first. That's very poignant, I believe. So can you take me back to that morning of that? So were you at the hospice before the exam?
I kind of stayed. And again, it's very weird things. Like my granddad had only died before this. So that was my only experience of kind of death and loss. But I knew, I just had feelings about things I really wanted. So I really wanted to be there with him when he went. And I didn't want to miss it. And I really wanted to read at the funeral. And I didn't have any, you know, there was no point of reference, but it was just something I felt I really wanted. So I basically, and my mum and my brother, we stayed probably for the last week, we stayed at the hospice as well. So we were kind of on the sofas, or like they brought out mattresses of like empty beds, and we'd sleep like on the bed next to him on the floor. Yeah. And so on the night he passed, well, like the day he passed, me and my mum had stayed. And we were both kind of, my mum was with him the whole time, and I was kind of sleeping on and off on the floor because she was like, you know, you've got an exam tomorrow, like try and get an hour or two sleep. I was like, okay. And then, like my mom was with him, and then she just kind of said, like, it's now, it's going to happen now. Oh, and I was like, oh, and obviously you're not really asleep, you're not really awake, you don't really know what's going on. So I just kind of grabbed his hand, like held his hand, and he went, and we had music playing on the background that had been on loop, like different CDs that he loved and stuff like that. And I remember saying to my mom, like, did I make it? Like, did I make it in time? Because I just didn't know. You're so like in and out of, and your dreams at that point are so vivid that you don't know if you've, you know, if it's already happened or what. And like it was peaceful and also grotesque because I think, you know, end of life is, it's not like it is in film and TV, you know, nothing like it. So
absolutely not.
It kind of stays with you for a while.
Yeah.
And I think, so that kind of all happened, you know, the nurse came in and like, we still speak to all the nurses and things like that from the hospice, which is lovely. And they all remember it so vividly, like the music playing, we all being there. And it was just like a really special, like heartbreaking moment all in one. And the saddest part I think was that we could hear the buzzer going, and that was my brother arriving with my uncle. So it was just like they just missed it. But again, you know, as I always say, he only had two hands, you know, and we each had a hand, you know, there was, you know, we were with him, so that was what was most important for us, I think, that he wasn't alone. And my brother was so much younger, so we kind of made him look, you know, like he was sleeping and everything by the time he came in. And that was just, you know, a much sweeter, I think, moment for him as well. And then we went into the hospice lounge. We had a cup of tea with the nurses and we all just kind of sat there like, you know, that was and that was like 5 a.m. So we kind of sat there until 7:30-ish. And, you know, we phoned all the family and all that kind of thing. And then we kind of had this moment where I was like, Mom, we're going to have to go home now. I'm going to have to go and get dressed, and we're going to, you know, we're going to have to go. And I would still probably say the hardest moment of the whole experience was being stood in the room and knowing that's the last time you're going to see him and leaving. That was the point that even now I'm like, whew, that was, you know, I probably would have stayed there forever if I had a choice. But it was just one of those things. I think that was the point where you're like, okay, this is the end, you know.
That's goodbye.
And so I think for me, even things like the funeral and stuff, like it was real at that point. That was the point where, you know, we stepped off a cliff and it was life without Dad now. So then literally came home, put on my uniform. I remember vividly just laying on my floor crying, thinking, oh my God, how has this happened? What's going to happen now? And just kind of like autopilot, like going. And my head teacher was there and he like gave me a hug and he'd work with my dad because obviously he was also a teacher. My dad had taught at the school that I went to. So he knew my dad. So he gave me a hug and he was so sorry. You know, I was just with my pupil support officer and she was like, you're going to have to sit this exam with everyone because it was like a French like listening or something. So I had to go in and be in the class with them all. And I was like, oh God, like this is what's going to,
did you go in sort of like, so yeah, you knew you had your exam that morning. Did you go in sort of like, I kind of hope school will go, nah, you're okay, you don't have to do it today?
I don't even know.
Drummed into you, just like, I've just, you know, you went home, you got your uniform on, you were going to school. Did it ever cross your mind and think that, oh, you know, I actually hope that school actually kind of let me off this time? Or were you fully like, I've had to do this?
It was just like, I don't know if I even thought about it. I think I must have done. Because it was just, I think, that conversation with Dad, like he was, and, you know, we'd had conversations before that where he was literally like, you know, I've spent my whole life getting other people through their GCSEs, like other people's kids through their GCSEs, their school life, you know, making sure they had an education. And now I can't do it for you. And for me, that was always such a, you know, well, this is what he really wanted for me. And I didn't think it was an option, I don't think, to not go. I knew that wouldn't be what he wanted or my mum wanted. And I didn't even think about like what the repercussions would be or how that would look. And I'd just resit or like take another time. But it was kind of like, just go and make a whack of it was kind of like, you know, where I was at. And I think that was the weirdest part, because you kind of had to pretend that everything was fine. So I remember I said to the pupil support officer, who was just a wonderful woman, I was like, let's just go at the last moment, hand in my phone, and I'll just walk in. And let's just do it like that, and then I'll be fine. And obviously everyone, because it was, again, this listening exam, so everyone is in the corridor, everyone is chatting. Oh, hi, Jess. Like, how are you doing? How's it going? Because, again, like, I'd spoken to my close friends and said, you know, it could be any day now, and they'd all come to the hospice and seen him, which was lovely. But I'd kind of gone radio silent and, you know, not said anything more. So I just had to put on a face and just be like, yeah, you know, it's fine. Everything's great. Let's go in. Let's just do this. You know, let's just crack on. And I remember there was a point halfway through the exam where one of my friends kind of turned around to look at me and pulled a face, because this exam was just awful and we were rubbish at French. And so she pulled a face at me and I kind of was like, oh my God. And then, and I kind of in that, I remember thinking in that moment, I was like, oh, everything's fine.
Yeah.
Like everything's fine. And it only hits you after, where you think, oh shit, everything is not fine. Like everything is not fine. Like even though those little moments make you feel so normal and feel so familiar, everything was not fine.
Yeah. Like your friend is looking at you like, have you ever anything? You're like, bloody hell, this is a load of rubbish, this.
Yeah.
And then you're kind of giving the same response back, like, oh yeah. But then you're in your head, you're like, you have no idea, my dad just died this morning.
Yeah, and in that split second, I kind of forgotten. I was kind of like, I'm just a kid. Like, I'm just a kid, we're in an exam, you know?
I'm just a kid doing my French exam.
Exactly, and this is hilarious, and I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And then that kind of went again. And I think for me, it was just the point where I felt like I was a kid before Dad died, or like before he was diagnosed. I was kind of a kid, but I was always very mature. So I was kind of a, you know, grown up kid. And I always thought I knew everything, but obviously I didn't. And then the point he died, it was like, I didn't know how to socialize. I didn't know how to be a kid. I didn't know how to be young, because I just felt like I was so old, because I had this life experience that made me, that aged me.
Yeah.
And made me just feel really deep and dark and different, you know?
And it's so hard at 16, at 16, to feel that weight and to feel that shift within yourself of, you know, that you're like, yeah, I'm not that. Even though you say you're mature, to know that, yeah, this has now revealed a part of me on a new chapter of my life that I know is going to set me aside from my peers now, and for the rest of my foreseeable, as you said, I've now experienced something that, you know, sort of at 16 you do associate, you kind of do associate death when you, like, as you said, the support people saying, oh, you know, I'm 17, I lost my people. You don't think you're going to lose a parent or a key person in your life at that stage in your life. You just think that happens to older people.
And then
so with after that, so you sat the exam, when did you tell like your friends? Did you come out after and go, I can imagine them coming out being like, oh, that was hard. And you were like, yeah, my dad died. Like,
you'd think it was hard. Yeah.
It was the
weirdest day of my whole life, because not only I had one exam, I had another exam in the afternoon.
That was cruel, wasn't it? But the way they would make us go back-to-back exams, like, you'd have one in the morning, like, crack of dawn, and then one before end of the day. I'd be like, you're joking me, I'm frazzled. Like, I'm actually frazzled.
literally. So, it was one of those days. And, I'd spoken to, like, my people support officer, and she was kind of like, look, you can tell them when you want to, but maybe just tell them, you know, after you've done this afternoon's exam. So then you've done both your exams, you can take a moment to breathe and tell them, because they're going to be just as upset as for you as you are. And I was like, yeah, this is true. And I didn't really know how it was going to go, and I felt really awkward about it, because it's quite a big thing to say, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you don't really know, you know? Yeah. So I went home, and the funeral director was there, and it was all like, we're going to pick out a picture for like the order of service, and we're going to pick a date, and we're trying to get hold of the vicar. And I was like,
what a strange day. What a strange.
Yeah. I was like, okay.
Yeah, you come home for a bit of respite.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, you're like, who's this guy?
I know. And literally I was like, I'm the person, like the keeper of all the family photos.
Yeah.
So it was up to me to find the perfect photo for dad. And I was like, yeah, sure. But I'm kind of looking through all these photos. And because it was so soon after, you can't quite, your head can't get around it, like that he's gone and he's not there and we're not going back to the hospice. And my brother literally baked cakes and went back to the hospice and was like, thank you so much. Because I think we all just didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
We kind of moved into the hospice at this point and then just moved back out again. Right, like, see you later. You know, what happens
thanks
now?
For stay.
Yeah, I know. Cheers. You were amazing. We love you, but we're leaving. Like,
I'll review you.
Yeah, I know. I'm like, what? It was so weird. Like, it was just so surreal.
Oh, gosh.
So, yeah. So, like, and family friends came round and everyone was crying. And it was a lot. And then, you know, I put on my blazer again. My auntie was like, right, I'll take you back to school.
Yeah,
I was like, okay. So then I sat another paper, but this was a written exam I could sit by myself. So I was just in, you know, just by myself in this random room in my school, which was very old. So it was very kind of like sweet and private and lovely to be in this kind of room by myself. And again, it was a religious studies paper, which is what my dad taught. So I was kind of like, you know, very connected kind of moment as well. It wasn't there was two papers, and I can't remember what the one I sat was, but it wasn't the death and afterlife paper.
Oh, thank God.
I was so grateful. I was just like, can you imagine? Like, I can deal with coincidences, and I can you know, sometimes it's funny, but I was like, that is even too much for me.
That's cruel.
Yeah, exactly. So I was, you know, that was the only blessing, I guess, of that day. But yeah, so then, you know, sat that exam, and I think I remember feeling like halfway through, when I was just kind of writing it or trying to figure out what I was meant to write down, you know, like, wow, like he's gone, you know, this is real now. But you don't even, again, that was like the first day of the rest of those anniversaries where I didn't really have a moment to think about it.
Yeah.
It was just like, here we go. This is a thing we do. We're gonna do it. So then it was only when I got home and I got in the car, and I remember being just about to say to my auntie, oh, we're going back to the hospice, like, who's with dad if you're here?
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh my God. Okay. So this is it now. And that was the point where, you know, that was just life.
Yeah, that realization. I can imagine like how your brain has gone there, because that
ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Such a long day. You've been up since what, crack of dawn, about 5, and then I feel, you know, them days where you're like, oh, did that happen today? Like, that happened today.
Yeah.
And you just, yeah, your routine and your lifestyle was, after school we go to Dan, go to the hospice, and we look after him, and we do what we do there, and then you come back into the same familiarity of getting picked up and going. You're like, oh, but if you're
And it's that surrealness mm-hmm. that will knock the socks off of you and the wind out of you. And you'll go,
yeah.
And she said, no, this is life now. We don't go to the hospice anymore. We just go home now.
Yeah.
And then, and after that, Jess, so what was life like after? So you've now you're sitting, then you've got to sit in the rest of your GCSEs. You've now told your friends. You already now sort of feel this shift within yourself of that I'm now feeling and going through things that my said peers are not. I know this is going to change me. I think to have that awareness too at such a young age too of knowing that this is now, because I know a lot of, especially I was kind of a bit like, yeah, this has happened to me, but it's not really going to change me. Like I'm still Amber, and it got to a point where I was like, I still battle with it sometimes even now. I think I'm still Amber, but there's old and new parts of me still now. I see old parts of myself, but that took me years to kind of acknowledge and respect that. But yeah. I think for you to have, I think that goes credit for you, you know, you saying that you're so mature at your young age as well, to notice that shift in yourself already. So then what did you, like your late teens and then you're coming, yeah, and going into your higher education as you went to university, and how much education was such a key part in your and your dad's life as well. Going through that, do you feel like your dad's profession and his love for education was a real spur for you?
Yeah, and I feel like we were very similar in that way, that I always wanted to talk to him about what I was doing at school or what I was learning, mostly about how, you know, my teachers would be like, she can only get a B or something. And I'd be like, how does he think I can only get a B? I can do whatever I want.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just like, you know what? If you try, you can do anything. Why are we putting ceilings on it? So it was very much like a very big conversation about everything I was studying, and I was just really passionate about learning and literature and like exploring different ideas and learning about the world and how people thought about it. And he was very similar in that way. And I think that did drive, you know, so much of my going to the exams and even having an education. That was very much in the forefront of my mind. And I think because we'd had those conversations, you know, I was a very creative person even then. And I was very drawn to kind of drama school and that kind of path. And I remember my dad being like, you know, do that after, like go do an English degree because you don't know if you want to be an actor. You just know you love being, you know, in that kind of environment, that kind of creative space. Go do English and then decide after, because then you've got that as like your backup.
Safety net. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was
that's the dad in him kicking in. That's the dad.
Exactly. That's the parent. Like.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think there was always like an underlying wish, you know, that I'd be a teacher. My mum's also a teacher, I am not going to be a teacher. I'm not cut out for it at all. But I think that was always like an underlying thing. And I think, you know, the way he thought about how every child deserved a right to a good education and, you know, it would help them, you know, in later life, which obviously it does, you know, if you have access to education, you get better access to jobs, and all of these kind of things that make your life kind of more comfortable. So he was very passionate about that. And I think he instilled that in me, you know, that this was just something, you know, you needed to do if to just kind of have for later on in life for the options that I might want, might not want. But I think that was something, because we were kind of connected in that, I kind of didn't really question my path, because again, he wasn't there. So I felt like it wasn't his, you know, dying wish or like last legacy, but I did feel like, you know what, this is what he wanted. And again, you're young, you don't really know what you want to do. So I kind of went with it. I was very lucky though, because obviously my sixth form, my A-level, so my A-levels and sixth form and everything was at the same school. So I didn't have to change. I knew everyone, and that was both a blessing and a curse, because I felt like, so we basically had about 6 to 8 weeks, maybe even longer, 9 weeks or something, since exams finished to then going back to school for year 12. And I'd struggled on and off with kind of these feelings of feeling very down and feeling very low and desperate. And it really kicked in over the summer, and it was like glorious weather. And I'd just stay indoors in my dad's hoodie and some leggings, and I'd just eat. And there was loads of other things that kind of built into this, but that was where, you know, binge eating came from, you know, when he got diagnosed, because it was things like people would bring cake, and I'd always call it pity cake, which is not, it's out of such a good place, but it's, I'd always call it pity cake because they kind of come and say, I'm so sorry for your loss, or like, I'm so sorry I was diagnosed to begin with. And then you think, oh yeah, like, I'm so sorry. Like, it's so sad. I'm going to eat this cake, you know?
Yeah.
And that I became like, exactly. Yeah. It is sad. You're right.
Mm.
And it was just like that kind of thing. So I got myself in this cycle where I would just kind of stay at home, stay hidden and eat and not really process things and not really know how to talk about it. And I'd go out and see my family, and that was easier because we all, like my cousins and things, because I felt like we all understood. We all knew what this meant.
Yeah.
And I saw my friends, and they were very good at like pestering me to come round, and they'd come round and that kind of thing. But I really struggled to keep in touch with people and, you know, not cancel last minute and that kind of thing, just because I would build it up so much in my head about what it was going to be like and what they were going to think of me and what I was going to say. And I think that, you know, as soon as I hit year 12, because I'd had that summer of those kind of, that loss and that kind of confusion about where I was and what, who I was and everything, I kind of went back to school and I didn't, I kind of just shut down. And, you know, one of my friends I remember at the time was like, yeah, it's like trying to draw blood from a stone when I talk to you because you're just not giving me anything. She was like, I know you're not okay, but you're not saying anything. You're pushing me away. And that was what I did essentially for 2 years at sixth form. Yeah. So I just didn't, we'd be sat, you know, in the canteen, someone would be having a panini, you'd be having like a pasta pot. And I'd feel awful. And I feel like I was just like drowning or like screaming and no one could hear me or see me, you know, and I was just there, but I wasn't at all. And people would be like, how are you? And I'd be like, fine. Because I was like, I don't have the words. I didn't have the language. I didn't know how I felt, you know, and I didn't know at the time I was depressed. I just knew I couldn't get out of bed sometimes. And, you know, I'd argue with my mom because I couldn't get out of bed and go to school. And my mom lost her dad very young as well. So she was very much like, you know, we keep going. She went back to work. And, you know, she was just is an absolute trooper and just, you know, kept going for all of us to kind of keep us all together and everything. And I just couldn't do it. And my brother did as well. Like he was, you know, he would cry now and again. It would just be the most soul crushing thing in the world. But he could get up and go to school and see his friends and talk and not, he didn't need to mention it. Whereas I just felt like, you know, we'd had this whole experience. We'd had this year that changed everything we knew and everything we were and who, you know, everything I thought was true about life. And now you just want me to go back to normal. I was just like, I couldn't wrap my head around it at all. And I didn't think I'd ever be happy again or anything. And I think part of me kind of thought I died with him. That, you know, that was just that part of whoever I was. And I was very like happy, you know, fun person before that. And I felt like that person had died. And it was almost like, and again, my dad was so positive. And it almost felt like an insult to be a misery because he was so bright and, you know, bubbly and fun. And I was like that, but I didn't know how to be that without him.
Without him, yeah.
Yeah. So it was such a weird experience. And I think definitely having, you know, education to go to helped. So kind of you work through A-levels and then it was kind of the next thing was uni. And you get through first year. And there's always kind of deadlines. There's always things to like occupy your mind. And uni was a great, I felt like, new start, I guess, as well, because I felt like I was the girl whose dad died. And, you know, was a misery and all of this kind of thing. And ironically, I wasn't even the only person in my year to have people who'd lost parents, you know, and some of them had lost them younger, some of them lost them exactly the same age as me. But I just felt like I felt like everyone could see it. And no one said anything. And I didn't say anything. And that made it really difficult to kind of work through those barriers that I'd intentionally put up because I didn't know what to say. So uni was like a new chapter where no one knew who I was before. So it wasn't a chance to reinvent myself, but it was a chance to change how I did things.
Yeah, it was a chance to, I totally resonate with this. It was a chance to kind of, you know, finally walk around your day to day about the big bloody sticker on your head of my dad died, my mum died. You can, and I felt like that year with I moved jobs in between when mum died. I left one job and moved to another. And I realised at that moment, I was like, I can actually be selective of who I can tell. My mum died. Mm-hmm. People don't just know because of word of mouth. Yeah. And I found that really almost like empowering in a way, because I could just be Amber. I could just be Amber for the day. I wasn't getting special treatment, which I'm probably, you might have felt through school as well. So maybe that maybe eased off a little bit and didn't put too much on you. And I thought, I can just be. So yeah, I totally get that, going to university. And as you say, being amongst other people who weren't just, you weren't the only one who had lost somebody. Kind of thought, oh, okay, yeah, this is new. I'm not alone. Mm. And I can be selective, and I think in a little bit, yeah, like kind of reinvent yourself, reinvent your, you can also like reinvent your intro. You can be like, hi, I'm Jess, and I'm studying XYZ, and it's not, hi, I'm Jess, and I know you know that my dad died.
Exactly yeah. That. And it is that thing where you can tell who you want to tell. And I completely agree, like it's so empowering, because you don't feel like everyone's looking at you like, is she not okay because her dad died? And you're like, no, I'm not okay because, you know, I did the normal thing of like stub my toe and then I got here 2 minutes late and I'm having a bad day. It's not, you know, you don't need to rush to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was very like freeing, I guess, as well. Mm. And I didn't have to, you know, and in sixth form, everyone obviously was kind of turning 18 and wanted to go out, and I didn't. Yeah. I couldn't quite bring myself. And it was so many things, because I gained weight and I didn't know how to deal with that. Mm. Because again, you know, people are so mean at school, aren't they? Oh, so it was just like another thing, you know, where you feel like you've kind of done something wrong for just existing. So I kind of got to uni and I kind of just kind of owned who I was. And I think that was the difference. And that helped me a lot, because then when I wanted to tell people, I would tell them. And I would do it quickly and then move on, because I just thought, you know what, you need to know for context, and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. That is, it's so true. Sometimes you're like, there's times, there is times. Yeah. I'm like that. And I'm like, I'm going to tell them something. And then I'll be like, oh, I've got to tell my mum. I'm like, I'll start going and I'll be like, oh, okay, in a nutshell, yeah, my mum died 5 years ago. And that's why I'm here and doing this. And so it always sort of been, people are like, oh, what do you do in your spare time, type thing, especially when you start a new job. And I run a podcast.
And that sounds great.
Yeah. And I was like, what's that about? Okay. And then I go, oh, okay. Basically, and then I go into it and they're like, oh. And then sometimes we just smooth over it. But you do, you kind of realize actually sometimes how much of your grief and your loss is so current in your life, and how much it goes through everything. You realize I actually do have to tell a lot of people in scenarios that you didn't think you would have had to before. You don't see how they would like correlate, but you think actually I do have to sometimes actually tell a lot of people that my person died for things to make sense to them. To the context. And you're like, oh shit, yeah, you gotta like kind of get your pitch ready of like, that's what I'm gonna go, basically, oh, she died.
Yeah, literally, you have to though. And it, because it happens so much. And I think especially at school, like it was kind of that unsaid thing that everyone knew, like you say, your old job, like everyone knew, you know, they know, no one needs to say anything, but it just really is kind of uncomfortable at the same time. Yeah. Whereas you have the new thing of you have to tell people and see their face when you tell them. Yeah. And obviously, if you haven't been through it, you know, you don't know how to react. And it's one of those things that, you know, you don't expect still young people to have lost parents or to have lost siblings, you know, or to have lost children, whatever it might be, friends.
Yeah.
And you just don't expect it. So I think when you come out with it, you have to wait for their reaction and just kind of, like you say, just keep going.
Yeah.
Just like, we're going to keep going, because you know what? It's just part of who we are.
Yeah.
And we're still here and we're still doing other things. They're just still part of the narrative.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so true. Yeah. Sort of just, we do just, I find it, I just say it and I always don't leave any room for the pity face or even the pity comment. I just go, yep, that happened, and this is, I'm okay, and just go along. And sort of like, you kind of see their face, like, oh, okay. Like,
They're so true, it's like the shock to like,
but we're okay,
yeah, but you're good, yeah. but you're good, and you're like, I'm good, don't worry, I'm okay.
I'm gonna cry every time, you know,
yeah, like, don't worry, yeah, trust me, like, we're okay. Yeah, it's very, very funny. Oh god, I can't think the last time I've spoke to somebody and actually, well, yeah, with my work, and that was, I just came in, I just went, yeah, my mum died, and this is me.
yeah. This is literally me now. I've just got to the point where I'm like, do you know what? It'll probably make you uncomfortable for 1 second, but
yeah,
the rest of us are living with it. And we've, you know, got comfortable with it somehow. It's like tagging along our little grief. So
yeah,
you know what? You're going to have to just deal with it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And just, I wanted to ask you, so obviously with 8 years coming up, there's, and mine's coming up to 5, and I find along the way you kind of personally like doing things to remember them. Like you said before, in the beginning, you would do all things, you know, dinner, or you still do dinner, plays, music, stuff like that. Bar from that, on sort of like, not like a day to day, whatever, if you do things day to day, or on the days that aren't significant, like anniversaries, birthdays, holidays, what do you do to remember dad? Anything big or small? What do you do to feel close to your dad?
So it's really interesting because we have this thing where I look a lot like my mum, my brother looks, you know, uncanny resemblance to my dad, but I am so much more like my dad in, you know, everything he was, and my brother is so much like my mum.
Yeah.
So they're like two peas in a pod, and some of the things they say or they like or they do, and I'm like, that's so like both of you, like I can hear dad, you know, in what I say to them. And that's kind of weird because I do feel like a kinship with him, but he's not here. So it's like how you live with, you know, and without kind of fabricating what he might tell you or like the advice he might give you, it's kind of like, how do you live, you know, knowing what he would probably say or what he would probably think, and that being similar. And to begin with, that was a really difficult thing because I was kind of, and it would be anything. I'd be in a classroom and be like, oh, you know, he'd find that hilarious. Or like, he used to work with this woman and she's like ruining this class. Like,
yeah,
he would find that so funny.
Yeah.
But, you know, and it would just be random things. But I think the thing that's always been has been music. So ever since he died, we have a very strong belief, you know, which is very weird. Like it's always something weird, isn't it, that you just kind of take on. But me, my mum, my brother, and kind of my aunties and uncles as well, it's just been music, you know. And the first time we went out for dinner, we were in like a pub, you know, after he died, and me, my mum and brother sat there and his favourite song came on, which is Viva La Vida by Coldplay. And I'm like, this is a great song. But it came out such a long time ago. And it's not like a really big song. Or it'll be like other songs that he loved, or we have videos to him dancing and singing about with, and they'll come on. And it'll be like, I remember being at York when I was at uni and I'd had a bad day and I would go in a shop and like one of his favorite songs would play. And I was like, well, you're here. I feel you. Like, I get you with me and I'm not alone, but it does, you know, it's not helping me, but it does, it has become like a comfort thing that wherever we go, we hear it. And we'll be on holiday and Viva La Vida will come on. And we'll be like, oh, hi, thanks for joining, you know.
Dad.
And it's just become like a weird ongoing thing that usually when we're having a bad day or we're getting, you know, a bit aggy with each other or something.
Yeah.
Or maybe I haven't spoken to my mom in a few days when I was at uni or something and I was just feeling really low or lonely and it would just come on. I just walk into a shop and it'd be on.
Yeah.
You know, go onto campus. So it's kind of become like, that's become more like an anthem. You know, that if you miss dad, it's probably you'll find him again in music.
Yeah.
But I think it's just, you know, and I think like with anniversaries, and I'm kind of writing about this at the moment with like visiting graves, like you feel very obliged early on to, you know, go to the grave and lay flowers at the grave and, you know, find them in one place and show respect in one place. But I just find this in everything and anything. And it's so unpredictable in that way. And it's definitely like music or like clothes or something will just get you and remind you of him. And I just think a lot of who I am or like how we would think about things would just be very similar. And every time I come to a crossroad and I think, okay, what do I do now in my life? Like when I left uni, even when I was at jobs, I didn't enjoy. And I'm like, okay, well, what do I do now? And it was kind of, I can have those conversations with my mum and the rest of my family, which, you know, I'm very fortunate to be able to do. But I was like, oh, you know, whose advice would be great right now? I'm like, dad would know exactly what to say. And I'm like, and that's the kind of thing, like with those kind of decisions, we would sit and we would talk and we would talk and we would talk. And yeah, there's just kind of a silence that you kind of have to become accustomed to.
Yeah. I love what you just said there, Jess, of if we miss dad, we'll find him in music. There's something really beautiful that it is true. I really resonate with that. I find that sometimes on the really bad, as you said then as well, but if you mum and brother aren't getting on and just having a bit of gripes, having a bad day, I find it all the time. I'll go in my car and then like her songs will come on and I'll literally go, you're fucking with me, like you're fucking with me today, like you're really
literally
you're doing it with me today. And it will just, it's just them, I feel, just pulling us back down again and going, I'm here, I'm always here. And I really love that as well, what you say about with Graves. I felt that too, feel an obligation to, oh my God, I remember the first couple of years I would visit that grave and relentlessly. And I would always, and it's not a nice trip, is it? It's very emotionally labouring. That's probably the most surreal moment for me when I ever do anything for my mum, is I go and I look at that gravestone and I look, oh my God, that's my mum's name. Mm-hmm. My mum is in this ground. What the fuck? I'm getting flowers and putting them on my mum. And I actually think within this last year where I haven't been able to go to the grave, I've been forced to find her in other things, in other daily things. So yeah, music for me is very big too. I love that. You've said very much that you and your dad are like, and you felt like a kinship. I want to ask you, what's a favourite characteristic of your dad? And one that you think that you've adapted and taken as well?
I think he was just like a very silly person. For someone to have like an important job, you know, we were a head teacher and everyone was kind of like, come to your parents' evening, you had to be like respectable and like, you know, pretend like you were an adult. He was just not. Like, he was just the life and soul of everything. He would be the first person, you know, to be, we were at a wedding for my mum's friend. I remember being like 8 or 9. And my dad was like, you know what? Let's round up the kids. Let's go play hide and seek. I was like, yeah, why not? Played hide and seek. And my dad, this was before the ceremony, my dad climbed up to a tree, obviously to hide because he wanted to win. And as he climbed down, because he was found, he ripped his shirt all the way open. So he was literally stood at my mum's friend's wedding with this gaping hole in his shirt because he just wanted to entertain the kids.
Want to get in there.
Yeah, he was just like, that. I want to play. I'm in. Yeah. And so that was literally my whole life. Everything was an adventure. You know, everything was going to, we were going to make the most of it. It was going to be the most fun. We'd go on long like bike rides and then we'd have like massive like chocolate sundaes at like the pub or, you know, everything was a chance to have an amazing time and everything was an opportunity to just, you know, live life to the full. And I think that was my dad to a T. Like, everything was amazing, you know, that nothing was ever just okay. Like, he wanted to, there was richness in everything. Yeah. And, you know, even things like he'd get home from work and sometimes that would be super late at like 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. And he'd come and stand over me and be like, are you awake? And I'd be like, well, I am now, Dad, because you're literally hovering over me, you know? And then he'd be like, okay, great. Like, let's go have dinner together. And I'm like, I had dinner like 4 hours ago, but I'll come sit with you while you eat. Yeah. And so like, I just sit with him, you know, and that was his time to like, again, just bring so much joy at a time where you kind of didn't even need to be awake at this point. He could have just had his dinner and gone to bed. But everything was an opportunity to like just have a bit of fun, have a laugh. And so I think it was just like his energy for everything and like life that I miss, because again, like I said, I felt like in such a deep depression afterwards that it was like I'd lost him. Yeah. I'd lost like his energy in this like bundle of joy and madness, really. And I always felt like I was that as well. So when I lost it, I had this whole like, you know, I feel like I am fun and I am an extrovert and I do want to go and, you know, do all these fun and crazy things and have adventures. but I'm also super anxious now, and I feel really down, and I don't want to smile, and I don't want to have fun. So I think that bore like such a big conflict that was like, I was like him and now I'm not. Mm. But I know I am, and I'm just very appreciative, you know, that there's light and shade now, and that, you know, he lost his dad when he was like 42. So he lived his whole life with his parents, you know, and had his own kids, and they've been grandparents. So it was a completely different circumstance. Mm. So I kind of think, you know, I think he'd still, you know, be proud that I try to be, you know, happy and fun and positive and find adventures and everything. But I think completely understandable, you know, that not every day is a bundle of joy because of, you know, the circumstances.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's really good as well that you can make the comparison there of that you see very much similarities and that you're both positive and upbeat, but you can understand and you can look at your dad and be like, you can always sort of go, you know, he was upbeat, and as you said, he lived his whole life with his parents, didn't really experience, didn't experience hardship, as I'm sure we all have, but you can look and be like, okay, he lost his dad at 42 and you lost yours at 16. You can compare that. Yes, I'm going to live a happy life, but dad, you did die on me at 16. So exactly. Things might be a little bit more difficult to sometimes find that light. But I think you've done a wonderful job of doing so. And lastly, Jess, I want to ask you a question that I ask all of my guests, and it's going to take you back to that young 16-year-old Jess. And I really want you to envision her in that morning, putting on that blazer and going back into school. So if you could go back and tell your younger, bereaved self some helpful and honest advice, what would it be?
I mean, this is so, it's so tough, isn't it? Mm. Oh, and I think, you know, it would probably be as simple as just tell someone, like just tell one person how you feel and, you know, write it down or, you know, send it in an email, like whatever it needs to be, get it out.
Yeah.
Because I thought that no one would listen because I thought it's going to take too long to say it. And saying, you know, I feel sad didn't cover it, but I didn't feel like I had an option. You know, it wasn't like you could just go into school and sit in a canteen and say it. I didn't feel like I could. But I would definitely go back and say, no, try. Like, if it doesn't work like that, then tell someone on their own. Like, just don't be afraid to be emotional about it or show something other than, you know, I'm fine, I'm good. Like, just be honest about it, because I think I would have saved myself so much time, you know, especially being so self-critical about how I was reacting, because I always felt like I wasn't doing well, like I should have done better. So I would say don't beat yourself up about it, and then also just tell someone exactly how you feel, even if it makes absolutely no sense when it comes out of your mouth and you contradict yourself the whole time. Just tell someone. Because there were people there and they would have listened if I give them a chance, you know, and I could have probably got something out that resembled how I felt, you know, a lot sooner than I did if I just really pushed myself to do it.
Mm-hmm. As it says, isn't it? A problem shared is a problem halved.
Absolutely.
And it's only until that problem becomes so large that people are kind of forced to come in that you realise, yeah, I should have maybe offloaded this on myself a long time ago.
Absolutely.
And you realise that there are people who do have your back and are your home team and will support you. They might not have the answers of, you could, you know, gobbledygook out. And they might turn around and they say, I don't have the answers, but I'm glad you've shared that with me, and you don't have to carry that feeling all on your own. Well, Jess, thank you so much. That was absolutely fantastic. I absolutely love listening to about your dad. Please tell the listeners and the viewers where they can find you.
Yeah, so I'm over at Jess K Bacon on Instagram and Twitter, and then my website is jessicakatie.com, where I blog, you know, about everything, the highs and lows of life as kind of a young person, but specifically talk about, you know, mental health in particular.
And your podcast, tell about your podcast.
I also have a podcast. Yeah, so I have a podcast. I love how you remember it. I'm like, do I?
Yeah.
You're like, I'm like, oh yeah, yeah. So I have a podcast called The Guide to Life After University to help graduates navigate the uncertainty of life after your degree, like entering adult life as well.
Amazing, Jess. Thank you so much. Grief Gang, thank you so much for listening. If you like what you hear as well, obviously, you know, the whole rate, review, subscribe, all that malarkey. And please do check out Jess and show us some love. Take care, Grief Gang. Bye.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. I hope you all enjoyed it and it set your week off to a great start. Whether you've laughed a little, cried a little, I mean, I think crying is good for the soul, or you've resonated with something that was said, thank you for listening and spending time out of your day to do so. If you like what you hear, please do rate, review and subscribe. In doing so, you're ensuring that lots more people get to find the Grief Gang podcast and hopefully help them too. If you're not already, check out The Grief Gang on social media platforms such as Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. I'm most active on the Instagram page where I love, love, love to connect with you all. For now, take care and big, big love.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.